You can tell me. Do you hear that any better? Is that better? Well, you let me know if you put your hand up. Is that any? A little bit more. I would find it hard to roar into the microphone, but I'll do my best. Okay. Okay. Maximum. Right. Is that better? Can you hear at the back? Anyway, let me go back. This poem is called Love, and it is from my husband Kevin. We in fact it frames this reading a little bit, because about 15 years ago we went to Iowa City to the international writing program there. And we took two very little children, both under the age of three, two little daughters there. And one of them got extremely ill there and survived. And I went back to read to the workshop last November. And I was really very touched seeing those places, you know, where Kevin and I had been 15 years ago and had such a struggle, really, with a sick child, and had survived and had come back after these couple of months, and had a great longing to do justice, really, to that return to the place. And this poem is really also very much framed by this book, which I have never forgotten, the great sixth book of the Aeneid, where Aeneas goes back down to hell. He goes over the water into hell, and he meets his old adversaries, his old battle companions. And they open their mouths to shout to him. And their voices turn to shadows because it's hell. And it's a great statement on memory. Maybe. I'll wait for the technology, okay. All right. Yeah, I know it isn't easy. Can you still hear at the back?
Yes.
You can hear. All right. Anyway, so as I said, I had a great longing to do justice to all of that. And this is a poem called Love, and I have a great interest in it for those reasons. Dark falls on this Midwestern town where we once lived when myths collided. Dusk has hidden the bridge in the river, which slides and deepens to become the water the hero crossed on his way to hell. Not far from here is our old apartment. We had a kitchen and an Amish table. We had a view. And we discovered there love had the feather and muscle of wings and had come to live with us, a brother of fire and air. We had two infant children, one of whom was touched by death in this town and spared. And when the hero was hailed by his comrades in hell, their mouths opened and their voices failed, and there is no knowing what they would have asked about a life they had shared and lost. I am your wife. It was years ago. Our child is healed. We love each other still. Across our day-to-day and ordinary distances, we speak plainly, we hear each other clearly. And yet I want to return to you on the bridge of the Iowa River as you were, with snow on the shoulders of your coat and a car passing with its headlights on. And I see you as a hero in a text, the image blazing and the edges gilded. And I long to cry out the epic question, my dear companion, will we ever live so intensely again? Will love come to us and be so formidable at rest it offered us ascension even to look at him? But the words are shadows and you cannot hear me. You walk away and I cannot follow. I truly wouldn't. I would find it very difficult to maintain. Anyway, thank you very much. But I do. I would prefer to struggle through. And I'm going to. This is a sequence called "Writing in a Time of Violence," which contains the comment from Plato, which is in the Republic, the 10th book. As in a city where the evil are permitted to have authority and the good are put out of the way, so in the soul of man, as we maintain, the imitative poet implants an evil constitution. It is out of respect that I don't have the great quotation, which really belongs there, of Primo Levi, who said, "It is an obvious observation that wherever violence is done to human beings, it is done to language." This is a poem called "Writing in a Time of Violence." It's had an alternative title of "Beautiful Speech," because, of course, I come from the country of this beautiful rhetoric, which is so difficult to protect your intelligence against, and so insidious, so much of an erosion to what goes on there. And this is really the fact that when I was a student at Trinity College in my final year, I did what was called the Sheridan Prize in Rhetoric. So I spent an enormous amount of time in the National Library looking up these very obscure phrases of how not to say things, all the old things like periphrases and all these weird Elizabethan ways, which, you know, had a point at the time of elaborating on speech. And there is, I'm sure many of you with Irish background, or some of you with Irish background, know that there is this slightly odd aspect of manifest destiny in Ireland, which says there are no snakes there. There are no snakes in Ireland. And because St. Patrick drove them out, it's a very common Irish observation, and Irish children are taught there are no snakes. And I read in upstate New York the week before last, and a gentleman came up and told me there were no snakes because it was an interglacial country. And so that did for that one. But St. Patrick has been struck off the Vatican calendar anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But anyway, we were all raised with the view that there were no snakes. And I look back on the time of the 60s, and I look back on that time of the last moment, the last chance, the way, although there is always a what if, always a hypothesis, it was a moment when it looked as if there would be a diversity, as if there would truly be a chance, and these moments pass, and you look back and the chance is no longer there. And this is the poem. "In my last year in college, I set out to write an essay on the art of rhetoric. I had yet to find the country, already lost to me in song and figure, as I scribbled down names for sweet euphony and safe digression. And when I came to the word insinuate, I saw that language could writhe and creep, and the lore of snakes, which I had learned as a child not to fear because the saint had sent them out of Ireland, came nearer. Chiasmus, litotus, periphrasis, old indices and agents of persuasion. How I remember them in that room where a girl is writing at a desk with dusk already in the streets outside. I can see her. I could say to her, we will live and we have lived where language is concealed, is perilous. And we will be and we have been citizens of its hiding place. But it is too late to shut the book of satin phrases, to refuse to enter an evening bitter with peat smoke, where newspaper sellers shout headlines and friends call out their farewells in a city of whispers and interiors, where the dear vowels, Irish, Ireland, ours, are absorbed into autumn air, are out of earshot in the distances we are stepping into, where we never imagine words such as hate and territory and the like, unbanished still as they always would be, wait and are waiting under beautiful speech to strike." Now, the whole point of outside history, the whole point of the idea of outside history, is that great sense of the exclusion the sense of the unwritten life, the uninscribed. And like a lot of people in those small countries, my background divides in that way. My father's was much more the Irish story. He had come from a grandfather who had been in the Crimean War, who had been a quartermaster, therefore could read and write. My father went to Trinity and Harvard and Chicago and was a diplomat, and in some senses he represented the Irish story. But my mother's background was completely different. She was an orphan. Her mother had died very shortly after her birth, and her father drowned in the Bay of Biscay. And therefore, like a lot of erasures in small places and small countries, there was nothing left. She was the last child. There is no photograph of her as a child, and no photograph of her parents together. There is nothing left at all of what was the story. And I once said to her, there has to be something. I mean, there has to be something about your mother. And she said, well, she had once heard that wherever my grandfather's ship would dock, her mother would go down to meet it in Ireland, because she feared the women at the ports. And so in that small sort of darkness, there is just one small, tiny chink of light. And I wrote this poem, a gentleman asked me to read it, called Lava Cameo. Again, it's from the new book. And a lava cameo, for those really of you, is a profile cut into volcanic rock. And in a sense, therefore, it's the inscribed face on the material of destruction. And it is really, for this poem, a thing which troubles me greatly, not just the past, but how much freedom we have with that past, how much ethical right we have to return and reinvent complex lives to suit ourselves and our expressive agendas in the present. So this is this poem. I like this story. My grandfather was a sea captain. My grandmother always met him when his ship docked. She feared the women at the ports, except that it is not a story, more a rumor or a folk memory. Something thrown out once in a random conversation, a hint merely. If I say wool and lace for her skirt and crepe for her blouse, in the neck of which is pinned a cameo carved out of black volcanic rock, and if I make her pace the cork docks, stopping to take down her parasol as a gust catches the silk tassels of it, then consider this. There is a way of making free with the past, a pastiche of what is real and what is not, which can only be justified if you think of it not as sculpture, but syntax, a structure extrinsic to meaning, which uncovers the inner secret of it. She will die at 31 in a fever ward. He will drown 12 years later in the Bay of Biscay. They will never even be sepia. And so I put down the gangplank now between the ship and the ground. In the story, late afternoon has become evening. They kiss once, their hands touch briefly. Please look at me, I want to say to her. Show me the obduracy of an art which can arrest a profile in the flux of hell, inscribe catastrophe. Now, the poem, I suppose, which is a sort of, in some sense, enunciatory interest for me, is a poem I wrote at the start of the Outside History sequence called The Ackle Woman. I went to Trinity College. I spent some of my childhood years outside of Dublin, and in London, and indeed in New York. And I returned to go to school, and then I returned to go to Trinity College. Trinity College in those days stopped the syllabus promptly at Swinburne and had no Irish writers and had absolutely no way in which they taught you in the literature course anything to do with Irish history. And in my second year, taking the second year exams, I went down to Achill, which is the small island off the west coast of Mayo, to study British court poetry. The Ocean's Love to Cynthia by Walter Raleigh. And when I was there, an old woman came up in the evening who was the caretaker of the cottage I stayed in. And she was quite an old woman. She was 70. And she pointed out to me for the very first time the side of the hillside down which people had come in the famine to eat the seaweed on the shore. And she was really one of the first links, living links, with in that she had known people whose parents had known people who had known the famine. First person who spoke to me about the famine. And this poem is really a way of revisiting her and revisiting that moment. And in the sense that I was down there studying a completely different rhetoric. She came up the hill carrying water. She wore a half-buttoned wool cardigan, a tea towel round her waist. She pushed the hair out of her eyes with her free hand and put the bucket down. The zinc music of the handle on the rim tuned the evening. An Easter moon rose. And in the next door field, a stream was a fluid sunset and then stars. I remember the cold rosiness of her hands. She bent down and blew on them like broth and round her waist. On a white background, in coarse woven letters, the words glass cloth. And she was nearly finished for the day, and I was all talk, raw from college, weekending at a friend's cottage with one suitcase and the set texts of the court poets of the Silver Age. We stayed putting down time until the evening turned cold without warning. She said goodnight and started down the hill. The grass changed from lavender to black. The trees turned back to cold outlines. You could taste the frost. But nothing now can change the way I went indoors, chilled by the wind, and made a fire, and took down my book and opened it and failed to comprehend the harmonies of servitude, the grace music gives to flattery, and language borrows from ambition, and how I fell asleep oblivious to the planets clouding over in the skies, the slow decline of the spring moon, the songs crying out their ironies. Now, every poet, I think, develops an ambition, and indeed in talking to the students of the writing program today, some of this was touched on. How much freedom you have to move around the poem is really a crucial question for every poet in every culture, and a very elusive thing to try to communicate, because in the natural assumptions about poetry, poets are free. But the poem of Ireland is particularly difficult to move around freely inside. It's a powerful poem with a powerful series of icons. And one of the difficulties of those icons was the fact that the national and the feminine were so powerfully put together in these figures of the dark Rosaline and the Kathleen ni Houlihan and all that rhetoric. And in that sense, the Irish woman poet has gone from being the object of the Irish poem to being the author of the Irish poem in a fairly quick and disruptive series of maneuvers, and has caused, you know, it is stressful, and I accept that in that particular country. I do. But I wrote this poem, Anna Liffey, and I'm just going to read one or two sections from the end of it. Anna, the Liffey is the great river that made Dublin. It is the Liffey that the Vikings came down. And it is said to have as its source a woman who came to the plain of Kildare in legend and had that named after her. That river was named after her. It is also said to be the only feminine river in the world. I'm sure that's like the snakes. I'm sure that is not true. But it is a very, you know, dearly held Irish view that the Liffey is a feminine river. And Anna Liffey remains the name given to it, either Anna Liffey, as you know, or Anna Liffey. And in the 19th century, many Anna Liffey factories along the banks and everything. But this, I deliberately wanted, in some sense, to try to write a poem I could grow old in and a poem I could die in. And that is not easy in an iconic culture. So this is the end of the Anna Liffey sequence. A river is not a woman, although the names it finds, the history it makes and suffers, the Viking blades beside it, the muskets of the red coats, and the flames of the four courts blazing into it are a sign, any more than a woman is a river. Although the course it takes through swans courting and distraught willows, its patience, which is also its powerlessness, from gallery to island bridge and from source to mouth, is another one. And in my late 40s, past believing, love will heal what language fails to know and needs to say what the body means. I take this sign and I make this mark, a woman in the doorway of her house, a river in the city of her birth, the truth of a suffered life, the mouth of it. The seabirds come in from the coast. The city wisdom is they bring rain. I watch them from my doorway. I see them as arguments of origin, leaving a harsh force on the horizon, only to find it slanting and falling elsewhere. And which water, the one they leave or the one they pronounce, remembers the other? I am sure the body of an aging woman is a memory, and to find a language for it is as hard as weeping and requiring these birds to cry out as if they could recognize their element remembered and diminished in a single tear. An aging woman finds no shelter in language. She finds instead single words she once loved, such as summer and yellow and sexual and ready, have suddenly become dwellings for someone else and not her. Tell me, Anna Liffey, spirit of water, spirit of place, how is it on this rainy autumn night, as the Irish Sea takes the names you gave, the names you bestowed, and gives you back only wordlessness? Autumn rain is scattering and dripping from carports and clipped hedges. The gutters are full. When I came here, I had neither children nor country. The hills were arms and the trees were dreams, and I was free to imagine a spirit in the blues and greens, the hills and fogs of a small city. My children were born, my country took hold of me, a vision in a brick house. Is it only love that makes a place? I feel a change. My children are growing up and getting older. My country holds on to its own pain. I turn off the harsh yellow porch light and stand in the hall. Where is home now? Follow the rain out to the Dublin hills that had become the river. Let the spirit of place be a lost soul again. In the end, it will not matter that I was a woman. I am sure of it. The body is a source, nothing more. There is a time for it. There is a certainty about the way it seeks its own dissolution. Consider rivers. They are always en route to their own nothingness. From the first moment, they are going home. And so when language cannot do it for us, cannot make us know love, will not diminish us, there are these phrases of the ocean to console us, particular and unafraid of their completion. In the end, everything that burdened and distinguished me will be lost in this. I was a voice. I'm going to finish with a poem which is a little bit longer and has a story about it and is really the story of the beginning of this reading, which was the poem Love. We did indeed go, those 15 years ago, to the Iowa International Writing Program. And that was the first time I had seen, really, outside my own country, where it is done very differently, poetry canvassed as a series of ideas, a series of identities, series of constructs. That's not quite the way it happens in Ireland. And, you know, George Moore said that a literary revival was six people in the same town who hated each other, you know. And it remains near enough to some of the Irish procedures. But this was the first time that I saw, I mean, poetry as this series of ideas, this series of constructs. And then this little girl, who was my one-year-old baby, fell very ill. She got meningitis, and she was tremendously afflicted, as all babies would be with it. And I never liked to read. Indeed, at the Iowa workshop, they took a tape of my reading and sent it to the doctor, who had looked after her, because he was an absolutely wonderful man, a man called Dr. Maxwell. And he must have seen that child 15 times a day. And he came in and stood beside me one night and said to me, "Tell me, Mrs. Casey," which is my married name, is your husband a poet too?" And I said, no, he isn't, Dr. Maxwell. He's a novelist. And he sent us a bill for $60. He had obviously factored in the economic possibilities of the... but we owe him a great debt. We had an absolutely perfect child who was returned to us. When I was there, I was tremendously conscious afterwards that we had been spared this enormous ordeal of losing a child. And I also would stand with him in the evening, and he had worked on some of the early stages of this disease, and he would speak to me about antibiotics, because, of course, the antibiotics were dripped into the child's head. And he was very interesting about it, and I was truly disoriented at that point and would think to myself, no one has ever written a poem to an antibiotic, you know, so that I was between the two, I mean, senses of it. And so later, when I wanted in some way to encompass what had happened and what was there and to give some kind of witness to what we had been spared and what had touched us and passed us, I chose the Dream Convention, which is the great elite convention in poetry, and where the poet goes down to hell, and as Dante does with Virgil and as Chaucer does with Scipio Africanus. And I go down with Sappho. And the reference I make to the Scolius Nightingale is, in fact, a margin note in Sappho's poetry made by an Alexandrian Scoliast, who said she was small and dark and ill-favored like a nightingale. And so this is the journey. "And then the dark fell, and there has never," I said, "been a poem to an antibiotic, never a word, to compare with the odes on the flower of the raw slow for fever, or the devious Africa seeking tern, or the protein treasures of the seabed. Depend on it. Somewhere a poet is wasting his sweet, uncluttered meters on the obvious emblem instead of the real thing. Instead of sulfur, we shall have hyssop dipped in the wild blood of the unblemished lamb. So every day the language gets less for the task, and we are less with the language." I finished speaking, and the anger faded and dark fell, and the book beside me lay open at the page Aphrodite comforts Sappho in her love's duress. The poplars shifted their music in the garden. A child startled in a dream. My room was a mess, the usual hard covers, half-finished cups, clothes piled up on an old chair, and I was listening out. But in my head was a loosening and sweetening heaviness, not sleep, but nearly sleep. Not dreaming really, but as ready to believe, and still unfevered, calm, and unsurprised when she came and stood beside me, and I would have known her anywhere. And I would have gone with her anywhere. And she came wordlessly, and without a word, I went with her down, 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 without so much as ever touching down. But always, always with a sense of mulch beneath us, the way of stairs winding down to a river. And as we went down, the light went on failing, and I looked sideways to be certain it was she, misshapen, musical Sappho, the Scolius Nightingale, and down we went again down. Until we came to a sudden rest beside a river in what seemed to be an oppressive suburb of the dawn. My eyes got slowly used to the bad light. At first I saw shadows, only shadows. Then I could make out women and children, and in the way they were, the grace of love. Cholera, typhus, croup, diphtheria, she said, in those days, they racketed in every back street and alley of old Europe. Behold, the children of the plague. Then to my horror, I could see to each nipple some had clipped a limpid shape, suckling darknesses, while others had their arms weighed down, making terrible pietas. She took my sleeve and said to me, "Be careful. Do not define these women by their work, not as washerwomen trussed in dust and sweating, muscling water into linen by the river's edge, nor as court ladies, brailed in silken wool and woven with an ivory unicorn and hung, nor as laundresses tossing cotton, brisking daylight with lavender and gossip but these are women who went out like you. When dusk became a dark, sweet with leaves, recovering the day, stooping, picking up teddy bears and rag dolls and tricycles and buckets, love's archaeology, and they too, like you, stood boot deep in flowers once in summer, or saw winter come in with a single magpie in a call of haws, a solo harlequin. I stood fixed. I could not reach or speak to them. Between us was the melancholy river, the dream water, the narcotic crossing, and they had passed over it, its cold persuasions. I whispered, let me be, let me at least be their witness. But she said, what you have seen is beyond speech, beyond song, only not beyond love. And I heard her say, but she was fading fast as we emerged under the stars of heaven. There are not many of us, you are dear, and stand beside me as my own daughter. I have brought you here. So you will know forever the silences in which are our beginnings, in which we have an origin like water and the wind shifted. And the window clasp opened, banged, and I woke up to find my poetry book spread higgledy-piggledy, my skirt spread out where I had laid it. And nothing was changed, nothing was more clear. But it was wet and the year was late. The rain was grief in arrears. My children slept the last dark out safely, and I wept. Thank you very much indeed.